Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." We as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom." With all they're getting, get an understanding. I'm going to welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. Excuse me. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And then that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening and interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or share with your friends. And also check out the Time for Awakening shop with interesting products and language classes and history courses and different interesting things from different professors on the continent and in the diaspora, in the partnership with a BB Toomey. So check it out. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're going to continue part two of our discussion, because when we did it Sunday, we didn't have our guest with us. It was a little mix-up there, and Dr. Rogers, his phone got taken, the Uber took off with his phone, so he wasn't with us last Sunday, but he's with us tonight, and we're going to touch on some more things dealing with that period of history that's really talked about in an African-centered perspective, the Reconstruction period that happened in this country, our experience here, and talk about some of the things and how we can use those as blueprints moving our people forward. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:14 here in the city of Philadelphia. And instead of being in the usual Freestyle Friday mode, we're going to continue our discussion. And maybe before the program's over, in the last few minutes, we can get into a little freestyle. Anything that's on your mind, but we're going to continue our discussion from Sunday. We didn't get a chance to include Dr. William Rogers into the discussion because of a little mix-up he had and lost his communications device, but he's with us this evening, and before we get started with our program, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, you know, just cruising on another Friday, and looking forward to having Dr. Rogers and you know, kind of help develop this dialogue in relationship to that period of Reconstruction, the lessons we should learn. I think it's very relevant as we look at the perspective, or at least I want to explore it from the perspective of reparations, because we should be looking at the same kind of development that occurred during that period.
You know, it's kind of interesting that we're continuing this discussion in the same week that this country celebrated its July 4th Independence Day, mm-hmm. because you see a segment of our people, and I always quote that scripture about our people are destroyed. My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. You see, always see a segment of our people that they make sure they show on the television that's so caught up in this holiday of Independence Day that they don't seem to realize what was going on during that period, how some of our people fought against those 13 colonies. You know, the whole background of our experience here, it's a segment of our people that's vaguely unaware of it. I'm not going to say totally unaware of it, but mm-hmm. vaguely unaware of what went on with our ancestors during this period. And we might get into a little bit of that in this discussion, but I'm kind of glad to have Dr. William Rogers with us this evening. Dr. Rogers, you with us?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes. How you doing, Dr. Rogers? I'm glad to
hear you. Both of you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you with us in this discussion, because I think it's a key point. I don't want to say necessarily pivotal, but it's a key point in our experience here that we could really see what our people were up against. I mean, for the 250 years prior to that, or more than 250 years prior to that, we knew what our experience was. But after that, the Civil War ended, and it was during the period that they labeled the Reconstruction, we could really see that what our people that were maybe under the illusion, especially looking back, we can see that that period in history was really pivotal, because the people that we really thought were our friends, and I'm saying that with tongue planted firmly in cheek, that they really didn't have our best interests at heart, and it was always looking for an advantage, even to the freemen or freedmen, as Richard was stating, to use them to their advantage and always monitor their behavior. Dr. Rogers, on Sunday, myself and Brother Richard approached this from just a couple of different areas, politically, educationally, and economically, how the what our people were trying to do during the Reconstruction, what this nation intended for them to do, and how it was derailed, and things related to that, as far as maybe the Freedmen Bank, our people organizing under the Colored Farmers Alliance, and things of that nature, and how it showed the power of what we could do once we really started uniting in some type of uniform fashion. But what we kind of missed in the discussion was your input and how you wanted to maybe approach this subject. So let's go back, and some of the things that you might want to add, throw into the pot, in the mix, so to speak, and some of the things that maybe you missed to get a chance to throw in on Sunday.
Okay. First of all, I want to say you all did a magnificent job last Sunday. I did hear it on TuneIn, as you indicated earlier. My telephone got hijacked, and I was unable to come on to talk, but I did listen to on TuneIn, and you all really covered some real good things, real excellent point. I really liked the way Brother Richard dealt with those historians that had written about a lot of this. Because really, that's what we're looking at. We are looking at what Dr. Jake Carruthers called intellectual warfare.
Yes.
It was the battle of the historians about, you know, what really happened and how this thing was to be seen in the 20th century and on. And I want to say right now, it's brilliant that you wanted to do this, because we are looking at a very similar situation now in our political life, of the same type thing. We can actually make comparing and contrasting this period with now. There are some similar. There's a group of congressional people that are the same as the ones that were doing the ones that doing in the after the Civil War. So this is timely. It is a timely discussion, and I'm happy to be a part of it. Let me say first of all, you know, John Henry Clark said that all of history is occurring again, and very clearly it is. And this history does reflect on some current activities. The period we know is the Reconstruction. We know that it began right after the ending of the Civil War, 1865, on up to 1877. But actually, it began before that, because even before the first gun was fired in Fort Sumter in 1860, there had been contemplation on what would we do if we have to end slavery. And how would it look and how would it work? And that discussion took place back in the 1840s. And as a matter of fact, the founding of the Republican Party was based on trying to address that question. And that became known as what we call, or what was called by the academic community as the Negro question. And the idea was, what are we going to do with the Negroes? And I'm calling it that because that's what it was listed as. It actually becomes a political platform. What are we going to do with the Negroes once we end slavery? What's going to happen? And that was the beginning, as it relates to us, for Reconstruction. How do we reconstruct Black life, African life, Negro life? How do we reconstruct that? Once we end all of this. And that was several replies. One was, we send them back to Africa. Very clearly, Abraham Lincoln was involved in the colonization movement. He even looked at that. Even prior to Lincoln, James Monroe considered that. And that's how Liberia began to develop this. We need to send them back because they're not going to be able to be successful here. And then the other question that became whether or not you were going to assimilate them into the culture. And obviously that was no, you're not going to do that. So then what are we going to do? Are we going to educate them? Are we going to OS? And then some said we just exterminate them, let's kill them and get rid of them. And that very clearly was a platform, you know, at that time. And there's evidential proof to show that there was a platform to exterminate Africans. And very clearly, and then the other question is, if we do let them stay, do we educate them? And economically, how do we prepare for them? And out of those Negro, what we call the Negro question, comes the radical, it becomes the Reconstruction platform. And that's what it was standing on. There's actually two of them. There's two reconstructions. Historians have labeled it two periods. That was the presidential reconstruction, and that was the one that Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Johnson set up, that once the Civil War was over and we did it, here's how we're going to reconstruct the South. So that came under Lincoln. Lincoln set that in motion in the 1860s and had it all written out and planned out how he was going to do that. And then, obviously, after his assassination, Andrew Johnson stepped in. And, you know, Johnson's thing was to continue with what Lincoln did, but he didn't. He switched, you know, he went to a more conservative way. And then that's when the second Reconstruction came, which was called the Radical Reconstruction. And Radical Reconstruction was based on the fact that the Senate at the time and the House were being controlled by a group of people that became known as the Radical Republicans. And they were led by people like a gentleman named Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner and so forth. And they believed in total emancipation for the Africans. They believed to give them the right to vote, jobs, and so forth. Now, the real issue behind this, there's always a hidden agenda of what they're doing and how they're and why they're doing that. Why did you have these white men that agreed to go along with that and how they do that? Well, there's some evidence that possibly one of the reasons was that Thaddeus Stevens was had black children. And he had a relationship with a black woman, and he had black children, and he was sort of being paternalistic, and it's all paternalistic. It wasn't for the real good of African people. It was just paternalism. And then Charles Sumner, the same thing. Steve Stevens was out of Pennsylvania. I can't remember where Sumner was, but he was one of those states. But then you had another guy named Benjamin Wade. He was a part of that group of radical Republicans. And they wanted immediately to, first of all, arrest all of those who had pulled out from the state, allow the South to come back only if they agreed to pass the 14th and 15th Amendment, you know, and some of those kinds of rules. That's the only way they wanted to accept handling that. And they were even willing to embrace some economic plan, but not the 40 acres and a mule. That's not what they wanted to do. If you go back and look into the records, they did not want to look at doing that type of thing, but they wanted to do something. And then you have to also understand that that group who wanted to change, make those radical change, were being backed by big northern banks.
Mm-hmm.
And those northern banks were doing it for the real reason, which was you got all that land in the South now abandoned, and somebody's got to take it over, and somebody's got to buy it. And build, you know, and continue to move forward with cotton and all the agrarian lifestyle that was coming out of the South at the time. So the banks wanted to move in and began to make those kind of moves. And so they backed this radical group of folks. And then, you know, you heard the story of the carpetbaggers and the scalawags who all came out of the North, coming down into the South, well, particularly the carpetbaggers. The scalawags were already Southerners. But they wanted to go down, and they were surveying the land and the people, and just to see what was possible, you know. And so, in the middle of all that, we were caught up into this political jogging. None of this was humanitarian; it was all political jogging for resources and assets and political power. Because a lot of the people that were backing those radical Republicans were big industrialists. They were backing them, too, in some cases. And so in that way, you know, we have to realize at that point, how is it that the Africans are going to benefit from this? But they did in some ways, because you were able to get some key African people who were who had been strong during the system of captivity, you know, and they were very active, you know. And so they joined that group of radical Republicans to help, you know, pull together some of the ideas. Because right after the Civil War, you know, they enacted the Black Codes and did all some kind of crazy things. The Ku Klux Klan came into existence, you know, so there had to be some fight. And a lot of the people that were at the helm in terms of African people during the fighting was the Black Church and those Black ministers. And a lot of them put a clearly, you know, step to the forefront, you know, and join forces with them and begin to rally the people, you know, throughout the South. So if we do run people for office, we need you to get out here and vote, support them, and, you know, do some of the things you kind of need to do that way. They, Johnson, and one other point, then I'll back up and give you a chance, that Johnson was an interesting guy because he was really supposed to be a pro-Lincoln. But as I said, he jumped ship. He, for instance, right after the Civil War, you know, the South was going crazy. They had race riots in Memphis. They had a race riot in New Orleans. So the massacre in New Orleans in 1866. There were attempts. Johnson wanted to veto the Civil Rights Act, you know, so that Reconstruction plan that Lincoln had part of it, and part of the one that Johnson had, they wanted to get that through, and Johnson said no. He joined hands with the South, and he vetoed. He tried to veto it, but they were able to pass and override the veto, and as a result, the Civil Rights Act 1866, you know, came into force. But anyway, the radical Republicans were able to do one thing that did put on paper what needs to happen with African people, along with all other stuff. And that was what they called the First Reconstruction Act, which passed in 1867. Johnson vetoed that, but they overrode it, which then at that time put it into as a second Reconstruction. And then they passed another one, and Johnson vetoed that, and they overrode that one too. And what it was, what the whole fight was, mainly, was voting. They did not want the African to vote.
Mm-hmm.
But he did. And as a result, that's why you saw a Harlem Rebel and what's the brother's name, Bruce, that ran for help me out, Richard. What's his name? The brother of Bruce Blanche.
Right. Bruce. Oh, man.
Right. That's how they got in there.
Mm-hmm.
And these were powerful black men. And these were men that, you know, had real power during the years of enslavement. They were getting folk elected. But what the South didn't want to happen, because what they did is they would get in and vote for all kind of different things that would have stopped the South. So they had to ridicule that. They had to stop that, you know, actually. And they were, and I'm talking now through legislation, because once the Reconstruction ended, then you're going to get the intellectual warfare. You're going to get the historians fighting about what it was and whether or not it was successful or whether or not it wasn't successful. And that's where Du Bois comes to the stand. But actually, if you go back, you know, historically, and you look at these things that were done, that actually were done, you then see that there was a serious legislative political war that they put in motion. They ended up passing a fourth Reconstruction Act, all about voting, money, and one of the acts established the Freedmen's Bill. Another one established a bank of African Americans, which eventually one time Frederick Douglass was put in charge of it, and the white investors robbed it. I know you know that story.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so there were a lot of things that were done specifically that you can look at and say that this was a very successful movement. And it wasn't just the white radical Republicans behind it. It was the black community that were pulling together and fighting. And as I said, the black church. The Freedmen's Bureau established a school, and they were able to put into motions state-funded schools for blacks. In 1866, right after the Civil War, they convened a convention in Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And it was convened by the National Education Association, NEA. And the purpose of the convention, the main line agenda, is how are we going to educate the newly freed enslaved people? That was the number one agenda. And obviously, all of the states were represented. The South was there with all its inferiority mess jargon. The North was there about what they had to do. Everybody was arguing about how do we make this happen. It ended up concluded the meeting. They concluded the meeting with the fact that they're not going to recommend enforcing education, but we're recommending that the states have the power to do it the way they need to see fit. Whatever the states need to do, then they'll do it. And so that meant those hardcore states like Mississippi, South Carolina, Georgia, and all of those, they would obviously say no. And if it was anything, it would be very, very, very minimal to doing that. Dr. Ivor Carruthers, Jake Carruthers' wife, wrote a great paper on that convention. And you can look at it. I talked about it the other day on my program. And you can, it's online, and you can see she looked specifically at what they were, first of all, trying to do. You know, one of the workshops was, is the African mentally capable of learning? And that was one of the discussion points at that convention. And as I said, it's online. It was actually the first gathering of the National Education Association, the NEA, which is the power broken for teachers, that was held. And it was in 1866 in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And it really did establish some real critical things, you know. So anyway,
we're still dealing with now.
Yeah,
you gotta look at that actual legislative history, you know, to see what actually was done, you know, and then from that you can kind of begin to pull together what that intellectual stuff was going to be. Because when they getting ready to go into the 20th century, and when the historians were beginning to write on Reconstruction, obviously they were saying that it was the worst thing that could have ever happened in American life. Well, what they were doing is that they were trying to argue points that would help support their idea of segregation. And so you got to kill Reconstruction, that if anything that it was good and that you saw the capabilities of the African in order to argue segregation and all of that. So that's where the D.W. Griffin film comes from, The Birth of a Nation. You got to make that look ugly. And that was a historian, a white historian. His name was Dunning. William Archibald Dunning was his name. He was out of Columbia University in New York. And he is the one that started the historical analysis that the Reconstruction was awful and that it really harmed the South, but the South was strong enough to handle it. And that it very clearly shows that there needs to be disenfranchisement and there needs to be Jim Crow laws put in place because the African is not capable of doing anything. And he was, and see the importance of that, you may say, well, we all know that ain't true, but see the importance was he had a lot of scholars who studied under him and wrote doctoral dissertations and wrote books and textbooks under his guidance, beginning to, you know, spew that kind of information. And that's why Du Bois said, we got to bring this from an African perspective. And he wrote his monumental work, Black Reconstruction. And he did it to argue against the Dunning scholars. And he did. He attacked them very well. There were some white scholars that agreed with Du Bois, but they didn't necessarily write about it. It wasn't until way up into the 20th century that a European scholar, his name was Eric Foner, F-O-N-E-R, he wrote about Reconstruction, and he agreed with Du Bois, and he attacked Dunning and all those Dunning scholars. But by that time, you know, schools like University of North Carolina, University of Mississippi, Alabama, all those southern things, Rice, you know, down in Texas, and all of them had already established the rules and regulations that Reconstruction was ugly, blacks were incapable of holding political office. So why are you trying to do a passive voting rights act? You know, to vote for what? They don't know what they're doing. And that was the fight. And that's why we have to champion Du Bois, because he put it in a scholarly way where he disputed the Dunning school. He wrote an essay after that, after his book came out. And the name of his essay was Reconstruction and Its Benefits. And he spelled them all out, pinpointed them one by one, and what the benefits were. And he agreed, though, that there were some things that did take place that wasn't good, that people did act clowning and were doing some not good things, and there were some people that ran for office that shouldn't have. But the big picture is that it did not. It was not a bad thing for the African. It was not a bad thing for the South. And as a result, there was the South benefited from Reconstruction.
Well,
I'll hold up there. And that's the full history, I think, of what we need to, the way we need to look at it. But like I said, it gets down now where it's an intellectual warfare. And you got a radical group of Republicans today, but they're Democrats now. And you got that Nancy Pelosi group, and, Elijah Cummings and all of those that are, you know, doing it. Trump is a Andrew Johnson. And now that the the Democrats, the Southern Dixiecrats, are now the Republicans. Mm. And so that is the group. And so they're clashing over some of these same kinds of things and the same kinds of ideas. It's almost like a mirror of Reconstruction when you get into it and really want to get down to it.
And wouldn't that make that group that you, if I understand you right, of the same Democratic mindset, of the Democratic
right.
Party mindset of that
right.
the South had control of at that time. They were what we call Dixiecrat now. They were the true Southern, what's that, oligarchy.
Right. That's right. And they were holding up that old guard Southern lifestyle. And then, you know, the old guard Southern lifestyle that we know, the plantation owners and all of them, they were English royalty. A lot of them came out of the English
right.
royalty. That whole fight in out of England, you know, pre 1619.
Right.
You know, and who they were. And it's just a carryover, that same group, you know. So when we look at, like now we see a lot of these educational institutions, for instance, like I said, like Rice, you know, and University of Alabama, Mississippi, you know, all of that was schools for these plantation owners and to carry those old legacies and to write the history so that the South stays powerful,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And that's
what's happening.
You know, it seems like all of these discussions, even the discussions we having that they're having now, goes back to what you just stated, or what you stated at the beginning of when you started talking, Dr. Rogers, about
mm-hmm.
this country having the discussion about the Negro problem, and it's
right.
a century old discussion that's been going on by white. By European, what turned into European Americans. They've been
right.
having this
yeah.
generational discussion since the beginning of this nation.
Right.
It started around the period of time that they're celebrating now because blacks joined forces with the British to fight against this colony being created because of
yeah.
what was going on here. And it was a discussion then about the quote-unquote Negro problem. It came up again
mm-hmm.
during what you stated, James Monroe, the discussion again about the Negro problem.
Right.
It came up after the Nat Turner Rebellion. It was introduced to Virginia about abolishing slavery and getting black people out of here. And the thing that's really strange about the European mindset is, and this is just me looking back, I might be wrong, I'm going to get you man's opinion. I don't really think that Europeans thought that black folks would be around after this period. I think that they thought through their experience with other peoples, whether it was the first contact with Native Americans here, the first contact in the islands with the people that were there, the contact in South America with people that were there. When Europeans, they didn't kill everybody that they came in contact with. They killed a lot of people, but they tried to make them slaves. They tried to work those people. But through coming in contact with Europeans, a lot of these people were dying because
right.
the diseases that Europeans had, they just, their constitution, the way they were made up, they just couldn't take natural contact with Europeans. Africans were different. And this man discovered it. And he's always been experimenting on our people, even to this present day. About our
right.
contact with Europeans. We were different. You know, you hear a lot of things. Oh, our people were here. We were Indians. We did this and that. If you look back at the history, all of the people, the native populations of the Americas and the islands, if they weren't killed by Europeans, the Europeans tried to work them as slaves, as they did our foreparents. And those people were dying in huge numbers. But when our ancestors came here, contact with Europeans, That wasn't a fatal blow to our people. In fact, we were multiplying. And see, that's the thing that you really got to look at the European mindset. They knew, or they had to understand, that this was going to be a problem for them. But they were so greedy for property and capital that they didn't realize that this would become a stumbling block for them until much later when they were forced to deal with the issue after that Civil War broke out, and then the after effect or the aftermath when our people that helped them win that war were standing there, were the last man standing, so to speak, and they had, were forced to deal with the issue right before their face. And then we see what they did when they were forced to deal with it right before their face. And I just wanted you men's opinions on that, how they dealt with that Negro problem. I want to touch on some of the things that Du Bois wrote, too, because I think it's key in our discussion. But I just wanted you men's opinions on what you termed that Negro problem, Dr. Rogers, and just a critical discussion on what you thought or how you think, Richard, too, how do you think Europeans was looking at our ancestors being here?
Well, one of the things I think you have to look at it from the economic window. You got to look out the economic window. And one of the things you have to understand is that American life from the 1600s all the way up to, I would say, the early, right at the beginning of the 1950s was an agrarian lifestyle. And that means you got to plant and dig and grow and cut down. In other words, manual labor. And when we start looking at machinery and the history and growth of machinery, in those early years, like the 1930s and 40s, that still was a luxury. And only the wealthy could do that. John Deere tractor out of Wisconsin came around in the 1800s. That McCormick tractor came in those. When you go back, you look at the history of those, that equipment, even the cotton gin. The cotton gin was that was a luxury item. Most cotton farmers would not have been able to afford that. So you still had to have that back-breaking labor to work those products and those farms and do that thing. So they had to keep black folk here in this country to do that, because many whites couldn't do it. They tried it. Native Americans couldn't do it, you know. So you had to keep that. And I remember that one guy. He said that. He wrote that in a letter. He said, right now we have learned that the only thing that can make the South profitable is the black, is the mule, the plow, and the Negro. He said that is what keeps the South profitable.
And that's why I think that the social control was their primary concern. How do we control or even create a culture amongst the Negro that controls itself, but recognizes that who is truly in control of them?
Right.
And I think that was, and that's why you see over and over, and I'm glad you brought up the 1866 Madison Conference, because you see over and over from the 1600s the whole question. I think that's why what's that, Mary, the school in Virginia, Mary, and so, I can't think.
Oh,
of
William
now.
Murray. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely William Murray.
That was basically to educate black people primarily. Right. And right. So the whole thing was using religion, but to try to create the mechanism for social control. I think that that's right. What they, and the, Ellie, I think what they underestimated was the drive that Africans had, or at least certain group of Africans, especially from different, when you take it early on, different ethnic nations, which were warrior nations, the drive to be free.
Okay.
Right. Right. Exactly.
You know, because those social mechanisms wasn't in place, which I want, if I can, Dr. Rogers asked you as far as, because I'm dealing with a couple of things in the lead up when you say about the legislation. So I want to ask you, because I'm, you know, really holding on to this, the Dred Scott decision as the template for the understanding of
what, you know, how to view, mm-hmm. how the Negro is to be viewed.
I like that.
Would you say that that is the basis? Because everything else centers around whether free, and that's the other part, but how do you see that the Dred Scott decision plays in Reconstruction, if at all?
Oh, man, that's great. That's exactly right. And I'm glad you reminded us of that, because I do believe that it is a haunting fact. You know, matter of fact, during the time, is all of the stuff that was going on in the 60s and, you know, during the Reconstruction, I called the ghost of Dred Scott, was roaming around. And, you know, is that there's nothing that a black man does the white has to honor. Nothing. He is a nobody. And they wrote that in history. People believed it. They accepted it. Tanner was obviously a Southern landowner. Tawney, the judge that rendered that decision. And very clearly, it set the tone. Like you said, it was the template of how do we deal with black folks. You know, and a lot of people, you know, one of the things when you look at all those civil rights legislations that went to court in the 50s, right after Brown, a lot of the groups that argued for segregation would quote Dred Scott. They quoted Scott. You know, go back and look at some of those cases. And I did. I've gone back and searched some of those cases. And if they didn't say it in their rebuttal, a lot of the amicus briefs of organizations that send those briefs into the Supreme Court making recommendations, they say to Dred Scott as a factor, even though it would be considered to be overturned with those amendments, but they didn't. They didn't overturn Dred Scott. They just added a different language.
And it sets the cultural. I mean, that's that, because the I don't even want to use this term, but it comes to my head. The elephant in the room is the culture of white supremacy. We have the, right. as you say, that's with right. the laws sets that's the right. structure that can be modified. But right. what at any moment that is constantly being reinforced is the culture. And it seems right. that those laws reinforce a cultural belief, even if they get shifted a little bit.
Right. But Rich, Brother Elliot, when you were talking about doing this program, you and I were talking, and I think it came the day you called it, Mitch McConnell had made a statement about reparations. Mm-hmm. And I'm laughing. It's not funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, you would expect that, you know. And he said, it's kind of like an out paraphrase. He said, you know, what do you think is wrong? You know, we gave you civil rights. We gave you family action. You know, we fought the Civil War to help you out. You know, so what you want? You know, reparations. And that's what he said.
That's basically what he said. Yeah.
And the thing that got me was that I think that we really need to look at in relation when he said we gave you a black president.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that's something to say, that we gave like we gave it to you. So when it went in that phrase, it wasn't that you right. out of your electoral or him
right.
out of his right. proudness, is that we decided.
Now that's Dred Scott. That's the ghost of Dred Scott. That's what I call it. I call it the ghost of Dred Scott. That's it. Right there. You know, that gives them the energy to say that thing. That gives Mitch McConnell and that whole, what's the one from South Carolina?
Graham? Is that Graham from South
Carolina? Right, Graham. Lindsey Graham. That gives them the energy to do what they're doing. They are now the old, they're the radical Republicans. They are now the radical Democrats. You know, and they wield in power because they got a president to back them up. And so, that's exactly right. So you're right. Dred Scott was the template,
and Elliot, if I'm kind of trying to work this thing out, because one thing that you mentioned also, you know, is the question of what the boys and the others, when they were recorrecting the analysis, the, right. you know, of what went on right. and right. during right. Reconstruction, and if I'm not mistaken, speaking it not necessarily because with the White Academy and even the new generations of the White Academy, they always spoke of things from their vantage point. But right. what the boys and later those who came, they were saying, this is how the Africans seen the this. And we're using the tools of the Academy to show you that
right.
your analysis is not correct.
That's so it raises another question I like to raise
with you is the issue of the, you know, the view, which is about law in law and the legislation between, and Ellie, you had mentioned earlier, where the freedmen and because those freemen seem to have been clustered in a certain geographical area and had certain freedom. And this leads up to the question about those conventions and, mm-hmm. and even mm-hmm. the Equal mm-hmm. Rights, the Equal Rights League. Because what I'm trying to get, what I'm trying to understand is, did these black men see what these, even these radical Republicans were doing?
Mm-hmm. They knew that Charles Sumner and the other one had very clearly had a fetish for black women. You know, that's the real deal. You know, and you know who touched on that bit real well, and I was shocked that he did, but he just touched on it a little bit, is Spielberg's Lincoln.
Hmm.
And he also touched on it with Lincoln. Because, you know, Lincoln, very clearly, there is indication that the woman that was supposed to be working with his wife, Lincoln was having a sexual relationship with her.
Yeah, well,
I think Lincoln was.
That's the first I'm hearing.
Lincoln was playing on both sides of the fence because they said that he had sexual relations with this guy for years.
So the black woman, which is why Angela Davis's book is critical, Race, Women, and Class, but the black woman had to handle the burden. She's the one, even though she may not have been writing the academic papers and she wasn't in Congress arguing, in a lot of cases, she was on her back, and which was making a difference in some of the things that you see happening. I mean, that's a horrible thing to say, but it's the truth.
You're saying pillow talk, huh? Pillow talk.
Yeah. Seriously. She had those white men under control, not willingly. Truthfully, I'm not trying to say it was a willing act, but when we look back on it, you know, particularly with those two radical Republicans that were leading things, them men love black women. Obviously, the point is, can you prove in history, you know, because, you know, they would obviously cover all of that up, you know, and not have that reveal.
Well, I think that they love to have forcible sex with black women. I don't think they love black women at all.
No, sexual love.
Yeah.
Not love. Well, let's
take a brief break. When we come back, I want to share with you an excerpt of what Du Bois wrote about the Reconstruction. And okay. I think it's interesting, and I want you and Rich's opinions on what he states.
Okay.
We're going to come right back with Time for Awakening. We usually do Freestyle Friday mode, but we're in a little special discussion tonight with Dr. William Rogers, and we're reflecting on that period of Reconstruction, which is rarely talked about, but we're trying to do it from an African-centered perspective to look at the goals that some of our ancestors wanted out of that period, the things that they did achieve, and how they were derailed, and how it reflects on what some of the things that we're facing now, and maybe how we can use it as a blueprint moving forward. We'll be right back to continue the discussion. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. I see a call on the line. We'll be right back to pick them up. After the break, I want to share with you some of the things that the boys wrote about the Reconstruction. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services. Representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that want justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Never mind because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world.
There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
If we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 9:08 in the city of Philadelphia. We're in Freestyle Friday mode, sort of. It's a continuation of our discussion on Sunday's program of the Reconstruction period in this country and our ancestors' experience during that period, reflecting on it, taking parts of it that can be utilized to move our people forward, and using that as an example of what our ancestors did during that period, what they tried to do, and how it was derailed. Before we go back, because I want to read a portion of what Du Bois wrote about that period, I think it's very interesting, and I want Dr. Rogers, you and Richard's opinion on what he states. I want to share with you, because we talked about the loss of journalist Bruce Dixon last week of Black Agenda Report. Any of our listeners in the Atlanta area, and I know that you're in the Atlanta area, Dr. Rogers, the memorial service for Bruce Dixon will be held Saturday, July 6th, 5:30 to 7:30 at Hanley Shelton Funeral Home. That's 473 Lawrence Street, Northeast Marietta, Georgia. Again, that's the Hanley Shelton Funeral Home, 473 Lawrence Street, Northeast Marietta, Georgia. That's the funeral for journalist Bruce Dixon. Getting a little feedback. I think that's you, Richard, on your end. Okay, that's cool now. Just want to give that information on the funeral for Bruce Dixon and anybody in that area that wants to attend. Again, that's Saturday. That's tomorrow, 5:30 to 7:30 at the Hanley Shelton Funeral Home, 473 Lawrence Street, Northeast Marietta, Georgia. And the contact number, if anybody wanted any information, I guess on the repass or things of that nature, is 770-426-6333. That's a Black Agenda Reports journalist and one of our past guests a couple times on Time for Awakening, Brother Bruce Dixon. Dr. Rogers, Richard?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Let me share with you this preface, and then I want to read just a portion of what was stated by W.B. Du Bois in his book. Let me read this first. In 1935, W.B. Du Bois published an influential book titled Black Reconstruction in America. This excerpt from the chapter entitled The Propaganda of History questions the ways in which Reconstruction was being studied and taught at the time. How the facts of American history have in the last half century been falsified because the nation was ashamed. The South was ashamed because it fought to perpetuate human slavery. The North was ashamed because it had to call in the black men to save the Union, abolish slavery, and establish democracy. And so that's what Du Bois said, the reasons for him writing this work. Now, let me just read an excerpt, because in his book, he takes excerpts of what some of these generals stated, because you know how things were set up. When we read the thing about Sherman went down and spoke to some of our ancestors, Richard.
Yeah.
In different areas in the South, it was generals, white generals, that was over some of the resettling of our people. Let me read what Du Bois states in his book, just a little excerpt. And look at what he's stating here, because I know that some of you I know that you want to comment on it, and maybe the listening audience will have some comments too. Let me read this. Du Bois states, in 1864, July 5th, Eaton, and this is a general that was over this area where some of our people were, it says, Eaton reports that freedmen were now disposed as of the following: in military service as soldiers, laundresses, cooks, officers, servants, and laborers in various staff departments. 41,150 in cities, on plantations, and in freedmen villages, and cared for 72,500 of these. And of these 72,500, 62,300 were entirely self-supporting, the same way as any industrial class anywhere else, as planters, mechanics, barbers, hackmen, draymen, etc. I'm not sure what the hackmen and draymen were, but etc. Conducting enterprises on their own responsibility, working as hired laborers, the remaining 10,200 received subsistence from the government. 3,000 of them were members of families whose heads are carrying on plantations and have under cultivation 4,000 acres of cotton. They are to pay the government for their sustenance from the first income of the crop. The 7,200 include paupers. That is to say, all Negroes under and over the self-supporting age, the crippled, the sick in the hospital. Of the 113,650 of those engaged in their care, instead of being unproductive, this class has now under cultivation 500 acres of corn, 709 acres of vegetables, 1,500 acres of cotton. Besides working at wood chopping and other industries, there are reported an aggregate of over 100,000 acres of cotton under cultivation. Of these, 7,000 acres are leased and cultivated by blacks. Some Negroes are managing as high as 300 to 400 acres. The experiment of Davis Bend, Mississippi, was of special interest. The place was occupied in 1864, and private interests were displaced. And the interesting, so hold on 1 second, because I'm getting a little interference in the back. An interesting socialistic effort made with all property under the control of the government. Davis Bend was divided into, now check this out, everybody. Davis Bend was divided into two districts with Negro sheriffs and judges who were allowed to exercise authority under the control of the military officers. Petty theft and idleness were soon reduced to a bare minimum, and the community distinctly demonstrated the capacity of the Negro to take care of himself and exercise under honest and competent direction the functions of self-government. Now, notice, Richard, that whites are writing this.
Mm-hmm.
When General Butler returned from Louisiana and resumed command in Virginia and North Carolina, he established there a Department of Negro Affairs, and the territory divided into districts under superintendents and assistants. Negroes were encouraged to buy land, build cabins, form settlements, and a system of education was established by Negroes. In North Carolina, under Horace James, the poor blacks were helped. The refugees were grouped into small villages, and their work systemized, and enlisted men taught in schools, followed by women teachers from the North. Now, notice what it says about the poor among us, Richard and Dr. Rogers. In New Bern, North Carolina, about 2,000 freedmen were settled and 800 houses erected. The Department of Port Royal continued and wrote, "Negroes showed their capacity to organize, labor, and even save and employ capital. The government built 21 houses for the people in Encino Island. The carpenters were Negroes under Negro foremen. There was another village improved houses near Hilton Head. Next is the development of manhood. This has been shown in the first places prevalent in the distribution to acquire land. It did not appear our first introduction to these people, and they did not seem to understand, as when we used to tell them that we wanted them to own the land, but it is now an active desire by Negroes. At the recent tax sale, 6 out of 47 plantations sold were bought by Negroes, comprising 2,595 acres of land, sold for $2,145. In other cases, Negroes had authorized the superintendent to bid for them, but the land was reserved by the United States. One of the purchases that was made, Harry noted, the other 5 were made by Negroes on plantations, combining their funds as they had saved from the sale of their pigs, chickens, eggs, and from the payments made to them for their work. They were dividing off the tracts peaceably among themselves. One-on-one, these were aforementioned in the leading spirits. They were 23 field hands they had planted and were cultivating, 63,000 acres of cotton, 50 of corn, 6 of potatoes, with many, many more being planted, acres of cowpeas, acres of peanuts, acres of rice. These facts were most significant. Under General Saxon in South Carolina, the Negroes began to buy land, which was sold for non-payment of taxes. Saxon established regulations for the cultivation of several abandoned sea islands and appointed local superintendents. But the payment of moderate wages and just and fair dealings with them, I produced for the government over $500,000 worth of cotton, besides a large amount of food, beyond the needs of the laborers. These islands were cultivated in ways for 2 years, 1862 to 1863, under my supervision. And during that time, I had about 15,000 colored freedmen of all ages in my charge. About 9,000 of these were engaged in productive labor, which relieved the government. on the support of all except newly arriving refugees from former enemy lines and the old and infirmed who had no relations to depend upon, the increase of industry and thrift of the freedmen were illustrated. By the conduct in South Carolina before the organization of the Freedmen's Bureau and by the decreasing government expenditures for their now check this out again. By the conduct of the South Carolina before the organization of the Freedmen's Bureau and the decreasing government expenditures for their support, the expense of the Department of the South in 1863 was $41,544. But the monthly expense a year after was steadily reducing until December of 1865, it was less than $1,000. Into this fairly successful land labor control was precipitated by a vast and unexpected flood of black refugees from previously untouched slavery strongholds. Cotton and the kingdom, but wait a minute, hold it. From the previous untouched strongholds along Sherman's march as he invaded two of Grant's areas in Mississippi. So we can see here, Dr. Rogers and Richard, that whites cataloged what our ancestors was doing when they took control of these lands. It mentioned here that, in fact, they were it seems as though that they were trying to see if our ancestors were civilized enough to handle their own affairs from how they're writing. And it states here that several of these towns that were created, that black sheriffs and black judges were set up, and it minimized crime and what they considered, in fact, I had it here somewhere, unproductiveness. I'll just use that term, that the crime and unproductiveness were drastically reduced under our people governing themselves. And it says that they showed startling, a surprising propensity for self-government. And it was mentioning how they were paying back these lands through them cultivating in the different crops of pigs, vegetables, other livestock, and things of that nature. So it showed during this brief period that our people were advancing leaps and bounds by working among themselves and cooperating among themselves. It mentioned how lands were purchased for thousands of dollars and distributed among our people that didn't have land. You remember me reading that? Now, this was Du Bois cataloging what our ancestors were doing. This, just as we stated Sunday, this became dangerous, not only to whites that didn't have anything, poor whites, but it became dangerous to rich whites or land-owning whites because they seen this as competition. So this reconstruction, so to speak, had to be derailed by both poor whites and whites with means. White society in general needed to derail this reconstruction, and they did. And we also see here that all of these towns, because we mentioned before that we had people on here that was cataloging the black townships that would have been created during this period. It was over 1,200 of them. All of these areas that was developing all of this agriculture and being self-supporting did not institute a way to protect themselves. And that was one of our ancestors' downfall during this period. But I just wanted to read that and share that with you, and then wanted your perspective on some of the things that Du Bois wrote about what our ancestors was trying to accomplish during this period.
What I find interesting is that Europeans knew that. They knew of the capabilities that the Africans had. Because they planted their gardens, they planted their plantations, they worked the plantations.
Okay.
They knew. But it would not go along and justify the manner in which the control system would operate. It wouldn't support that. Because you remember they saying that the reason that we did do that, our ancestors did do that, is because we didn't have anything from where we came from. We came out of trees. We were uneducated, uncivilized, and that's the reason why we're doing what we're doing. It wouldn't support that. And why would that be important to support? Well, because America is just a dot on the system called planet Earth. There are other conglomerate governmental structures around the planet that were watching all of this. And they were watching it for many reasons, in terms of possible collaboration and power building, so forth. But you wouldn't been able to support the logic that what America was saying and what the English were putting forward, and the French, and all those that were involved. If you said that we knew that they were capable of these kinds of things. So, you know, you've got two kinds of historians that are writing a lot of times. You've got the ones that are trying to determine whether something is true. And very clearly, the school that was writing this negative Reconstruction history was trying to write it and research it, supporting that the African was ignorant and it was not able to rule himself nor rule anything, particularly our place, our country. And why are we letting them do that? You got to prove that. You got to go into history and prove that attempt. And then, and basically what it boils down to is interpretation of what you see. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other historian that has a conclusion, a thesis, and his idea is to prove that thesis. And that's a research, and that's Du Bois. And Du Bois was careful. And I tell everybody, I think I said it to you once before on the program, to both you and Richard, the Philadelphia Negro,
mm-hmm.
Is a monumental research sociological treatise that I think is still to this day sets the standard for how you're going to write history about African people. And then I guess the where the power comes in, and reason why it seeps in anyway, this negative, and they don't tell us, is based on plain and simple, who owns publishing, who owns the publishing house, and who accepts the material. There are a lot of publishers wouldn't accept Du Bois's work. You know, he had to fight like crazy to get publishers to accept his stuff so that he could put it out there. And why is that important? Well, that's who writes the textbooks for people to read. And learn and study and act. So Mitch McConnell is reading that school of thought that says it didn't work. And Lindsey Graham, and I don't know if Donald Trump even reads, but he's listening to those folks who did read. He's listening to the ones that do read that mess. And they are coming back supporting that. You know, there was many congressional arguments over whether or not the African was inferior. That's how Dred Scott came into work.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Taney was a lawyer, judge, and he had been reading and had been taught that you're dealing with an inferior species. They don't have a brain. They are a branch. They're not a branch of the human family. They are offshoot of the human family. And there were people that were believing that, and so they passed laws to do that. They set public policy to do that, you know, and even to the point they sold to us. Many of our people believe that crap.
Mm-hmm.
We believe we got cursed by Ham, by God, in the curse of Ham. You know how many preachers have preached that in their pulpits?
And still preach it.
Right, exactly. Well, you know we cursed, so we got to kind of turn to God and pray more. You know, that kind of mess. So I guess the argument, so that what you just read, Brother Elliot, is the brilliance of Du Bois. Now, Du Bois has some some issues too, but basically his scholarship was sound.
And that goes to, you know, doing, you know, the contribution of doing those sociological surveys, yeah. You know, because that was really the basis of placing, because even when he gives the example of the social order, that the class structure, you know, being conscientious, that you had Africans who had wealth. Mm-hmm. And Africans who didn't, but being placed because they recognized the same cultural division, they were able to, Elliot, that piece you're saying about even regulate in relationship to having sheriffs and judges and the downplay. It was about the work that had to be done in front of them. I think that becomes, you know, the cultural aspect,
right,
of what, Du Bois, it wasn't as explicit as the political and economic aspect.
And I don't want to leave out Carter Woodson either, because Carter Woodson yes. is right there with
him. Right, right. And I mean, that was the whole category of scholars who were coming out of the academy,
yes,
who were arguing against that. But I think that the lessons that we, you know, looking at that is, you know, the question because you kind of touched on it, Dr. Rogers, in the sense of France, I think it was France and England were going to, or at least England was going to support the South during the Civil War because of the cotton industry. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's who they went to get loans. So but here, because they had free labor. So mm-hmm. here you're creating if Africans are able to create the same outcome and product, and the labor is already cheap because they already have the social capital. So they mm-hmm. don't necessarily have to build. They don't have to pay for, and that was what the South was getting over with. They had to pay. If they used anybody else's labor, they would have had to pay. If they would have had to pay, that would have been an expense. Having free labor with that kind of skill that you laid out, Elliot, that, they would have been able to negotiate terms that would have undercut even the manufacturers
mm-hmm.
here, mm-hmm. you know, in the mm-hmm. North. So that was another reason, and them, you know, and once again, because what you're saying, what Du Bois is showing, it's the military that is doing the noun is called anthropological study. It's the right. military that's doing that. They're surveying how the social formation is coming together and putting it in their report. So mm-hmm. everybody else, even the journalists, will have to get that formation from the military, and it becomes a military threat to the mm-hmm. the establishment of the American Euro, you know, one capitalism in general. Because I think, what, it was in 1854 they had a economic downturn?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, so from 54 to going into the Civil War, they were just recovering from a depression.
Yes. That's exactly right. Yeah. And the whole battle over the money and the backing of the money, that was a real issue, you know, because, you know, gold is the standard of wealth didn't come up till later. They were backing up that money from agriculture.
Right, right.
So you got to control the agriculture. And controlling the agriculture means you got to control who? The worker.
The work, that labor. And when you got free labor, you've cut down a large part of your expense.
Exactly.
One thing that I see, I like to, you know, based off of what you read, Elliot, and what you said, Dr. Rogers, because the difference between Reconstruction, you know, looking at the history and what is it we can learn to now, mm-hmm. I don't see that we have the same level of social responsibility. I'm making this argument, social responsibility, or even have control over our social capital. And I think that what you had laid out earlier about the educational drive, because it seems that especially after the civil rights, you know, those victories, the push for education becomes a legal battle, but it also becomes the indoctrination of the mind, that pulling out those people who were, as you read, Elliot, those educators came from the soldiers who were already freedmen, that were already in the work in the South, and those educators that came from those women, primarily, who came from the North to educate. And they were instilling, they weren't instilling the same orthodoxy as Dr. Carruthers called that new orthodoxy of the inferiority that comes out of the 1750 that leads up to social, I mean, was that scientific racism by 1880, 1890. So, you know, that's, I see that as different when we look at Reconstruction and we look at being able to control and one, having all those skill sets that works towards, that could work towards a certain enterprise, then it was land and the outcome. I don't see that we have that kind of consolidation of social responsibility or understanding of how to utilize the social capital towards our best interests. And Elliot, when you read that, you were seeing they brought the expenses down in a short amount of time and they increased the wealth ownership in that same amount of time. You know, and that's all because of the social network they had.
Exactly.
It seems to me.
And yeah, you know, there's so many factors you have to look at in this whole thing. You know, you look at the economic, the political, the social, and you can't rule out the religious either. Spiritual was very critical in a lot of that. But a lot of it, though, when you're dealing with America, is the economic, political stuff that was going on that has a lot to do with it. Because, you know, even in the midst of all the Civil War, when you said something very important, but Richard, you mentioned the fact that England was going to support the South because they wanted that cotton. The North needed to try to stop that. So what they did is they created these embargoes to block the waterways, you know, so they couldn't ship those the goods into England, you know, because they had an antiquated shipping system. So now that means that somebody is going to work trying to redo how to create ships, you know, and that's where the steamboat came in, because the steam was being created at the same time. And all the stuff that Isaac Newton was doing out of England and so forth. So steam had begun. Steel was coming into the operation, the locomotive. Now you can use trains to ship that stuff everywhere. You know, so all of that's a part of it. All of that's a part of it. And that's one of the reasons the North wanted to shut that agricultural part down, because if it could get that steel, the steam, the trains moving, get that ship industry up and going, you know, they could rule all of that.
You know? And you raise an important point, because the manufacturing infrastructure was primarily in the North.
In the North, that's right.
And the other thing, as you said, which is parallel to now, then it was going into the second, what they call the second industrial revolution.
Right. Exactly.
You know, of steam power and being
steam
able
power,
to move, because that's how the trains were being moved by the coal and then also the whole thing for the transportation. Where now they're saying the shift is into the fourth industrial revolution, and that's why there are so many white males out of work, because there's no more manufacturing jobs, and the political backlash that's occurring after a downturn here was 2007, 2008, you know, almost the collapse of the system. And in that 1850 through 1854 on, they were talking about the collapse of the system. And it was a run to where they couldn't get
Right.
It was their primary thing that they, you know, that nobody wanted to loan those landowners money so that they can be able to get the goods, produce the goods in order to put it on, right. put it in the market. And the North was controlling that.
Yeah, that was the place, because they even had the shoreline. New York had the longest shoreline on the eastern coast of America. New York down into Delaware, you know, that's the longest coastline anywhere. So those big ships could come into New York. And along, that's why everything is out of New York. The Garment Center, the everything, you know, and all the way down to the harbor, down Baltimore, down your way, Philadelphia, Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
That was it, you know. So they got to control that, not only just economically, they control it politically. And how they control it politically, and this is where the radical Republicans come in to help us understand the connection, they all came out of the Whig Party. The Whigs, the W-H-I-G party out of England, which was the rich landowners. Those Whigs control the wealth of England.
Right.
And so what they did is pass those political possibilities over to the American side, and that's how the North was able to do what they did.
And what I find, and that's why I guess I'm making this distinction between freedmen and freedmen, is that there is a group of black men who were a part of, identified with the Whig Party. That, you know, even though they weren't English, they were supportive, because the Whigs turned into Republicans, right?
Exactly.
But then you talk about those who go back to you know, especially in the North, who had had free papers, their political alliances would be say Stevenson, you know, and those abolitionists, those white abolitionists,
mm-hmm.
who
right.
on one
right.
hand trace their economic lineage back to England,
that's right. And you know, I make the argument that American economics and politics is basically an international structure.
It's not
American people. That's not what this is. This is international. You got the French who this comes out of history. The French were here first. They came over here in the Spanish. They were over here even before the Civil War began, eating up land and putting their planting their seeds, you know, where they needed to plant them. And even though you had an independent, the War of Independence, you think England was going to back up out of that? There was no way that England was going to back out of America and let those colonies go just because of 1776. So the July the 4th celebration, it is not only a farce for us, it was a farce for them too, because there's no independence.
And let me mention this too, because and going back, I'm kind of reflecting on what Du Bois wrote about our ancestors, and you can see clearly during this period that our people, because you mentioned, Dr. Rogers, about the church being involved, and you can see that the early education of our people, the church was heavily involved, and the black politician was facilitating a lot of the things that I read. But the black politician and the church at that time is totally different from what you see now.
Right.
The values that our people had was still African-centered. Even after all of that period of enslavement, it was still vestiges of our African-centered values in our people's behavior. I'm going to reflect back on two portions. It's several pieces of evidence in what these whites wrote in their observation of our people during this period. But let me reflect back to what Du Bois, the passages that he wrote based on what those men wrote about what they observed.
Okay.
Let me go back. It says in New Bern, North Carolina, about 2,000 freedmen were settled and 800 homes were erected. But it says that the refugees, that black refugees, what they considered refugees, were pouring in from former slave lands, but they were grouped into small villages, and their work was systematized. And former enlisted men taught in the schools, followed by women from the north and from outside the community of New Bern. About 2,000 freedmen were settled and 800 homes erected. The Negroes showed their capacity to organize labor and even save and employ capital. The government built 21 homes in Encino Islands, but the carpenters that built the rest of the homes were Negroes under Negro foremen, and there were other villages improved near Hilton Head. So we can see here that our people that were pouring in, it wasn't about, well, I got mine, you get yours, fighting among themselves, the ones that had robbing others that didn't. It stated that when our people were coming in and with whites wrote here as considering them refugees, that the people that were building were helping the others. It also states here that that blacks, it says Negroes bought former plantations, combining their funds that they had saved from the sale of their pigs, chickens, eggs, and from the payments made to them for their work. And they were dividing the tracts of land that they purchased peaceably among themselves. So those are vestiges of an African-centered behavior that wasn't European at all. They weren't dividing nothing among. The Europeans had, it was a fee for everything they did. If you didn't have it, you were poor. There was have and have nots. That was what they were all about. But you can see vestiges of our people's African-centered values in what they were doing during this period. I think that had been poisoned. Go ahead.
To add to that, in the book one, African American, the History of Black Business in America, Juliet Walker, and I'm only reemphasizing that point as far as the collective, because when the Freedmen Bank, they stole all the money out of it.
Right.
By 1874, and this is a line that she puts in there to give numbers to what you're saying. In June of 1874, at the insistence of the Comptroller of Currency, the Freedmen Bank was closed, owing 62,131 deposits, $2,939,925 during its existence. 57 million had been deposited by blacks. 57 million.
Wow.
And this is 1874.
Oh, my goodness.
So in 10 years, less than 10 years, when you talk about that social, the social cohesion and the consciousness of thrift.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's definitely a collective
that
work.
Exists.
That was a collective work and responsibility one to another.
Right there in the act, right. That's exactly right. And you know where, Brother Richard, you know where most of that money in those Freedmen's Bank came from?
What's that?
The black church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right there in your hometown, Brother Richard, Brother Elliot, at the AME, Episcopal
right.
Church, in the 1850s. And DuBois, this is DuBois' work. I'm quoting DuBois. In 1856, they had 75,000 members.
Mm.
In 1866, they had 200,000. So if every member in that, in all of the AM churches, if all of the members put 10 cents in the plate, you can imagine the amount of wealth that was accumulated in those black churches that they were depositing in that bank, in those banks, because that's the only one they could trust.
and it still goes, I'm puzzled in trying to, we say that, and you see the evolution of African centered historical, context now.
Right.
I mean, even from Du Bois and Carter Woodson, it's been evolving as far as trying to actually give agency and voice of our perspective. So when I look at the political, I'm trying to get, because it seems like I haven't seen enough yet, and it ain't like I've been looking that hard, but where there has been a, in these political formation, again, the Equal Rights League or the Negro Conventions or convention, mm-hmm. yeah. and, yeah. and yeah. other, and even the, what's the other one? The National Afro-American League. I don't see in the documents, they're clearly understanding that they're in a hostile environment compared to they're trying to prove that if they do the right thing, they'll be treated in the right way.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right. And you see, that's what you just said there is key, because if you don't see that, then you think you can continue to still build that there's hope here. But right. there were a lot quietly, you know, and it wasn't public because of the dangers that it was, but there were a lot looking at the idea of getting out of America.
Mm-hmm.
When I read and I researched that Prince Hall, now he's in slavery during the antebellum period. Prince Hall was pushing to get out of America. He said, we can't live here. You're not going to be able to live here. And this was the 1700s.
Right. And then Martin Delaney, you know, up to the point. And it seems that T. Thomas Fortin, and I'm trying to remember the person who had the split with that, you know, as far as the league before the NAACP, was a Harvard grad. Also, but he didn't agree with having white people a part of the association. There was some that recognized the, you know, that Elliot, what you had read, you know, as far as what they had told the general, mm-hmm. that they wanted to, you know,
live by themselves,
not because of they wanted to be separate, but because white society is hostile to him. It was a clear understanding amongst that leadership, but it seems that, and that's again, Freedmen understood that and moved towards that. Freemen did not. That's the, you know, the amount of there were black towns in the North, and black people in the North had freedom by paper earlier than those in the South. It took the Civil War to get those in the South. And the political associations really were primarily early on by free black men in the North and the Midwest. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Ohio, Maine, Ohio, whatever, which had a different point of view about the political associate, and also become the leaders, right? Even Du Bois comes out of Maine in his thinking compared to Booker T. You know, so that's, I don't know if it's appropriate, but I think that we have to wrestle with that, because some of the gaps in not seeing that this system as it's constructed was not meant to give, to really answer the Negro question in favor of the Negro.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're right.
You're exactly right. And that's our challenge now. What do we do moving forward? You find a lot of people with different ideas. Some of our people feel as though the answer is doing it politically. Some people know that the answer is not just political, but it's going to take intestinal fortitude from our people to detach themselves from quote-unquote American values. Because that's a poison to our people. And some of our people don't realize it. That's a poison to our people. It's almost like you living in a house that's contaminated with lead. You don't see it happening to you, but it's happening just the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, this is a discussion that's going to continue. You know, more and more we see that the political development, or maybe the political underdevelopment of this country,
underdeveloped. Yeah,
and the downward spiral that this country is on. I don't believe it's on the ascension. It's on a downward spiral. Our people got to decide, whether we're going to stay on the train till it hits the wall, or whether we're going to try to make a way to jump off, so to speak. We have to do something other than what's happening here. This is our dilemma, and this is our struggle. And
that's right.
Those are some of the things we try to deal with, the issues, some of the things that's before us. You tackle a lot of these issues on Black Reality Think Tank, and Brother Ushi talks about a lot of these issues. We try to deal with them on Time for an Awakening. So we're just going to
–
the struggle continues, as I say, Brother
Dr. Rogers. Got to keep behind. Yeah.
And I appreciate being able to, kind of bring it up, because I think it has to be one thing that Jacob Correll just really wanted to make that distinction, that the scholarship has to also come from not just from the academy, but outside the academy. The people in the community themselves have to do the research in order to give voice or view of how this thing looks to help us in how we move. Because if we just go by the academy, we know they'll just keep modify, but that you need to be under control. Or we need to control you too. Yeah, you can have some control, but we need to control you. I mean, that's, and these are the reasons why, you all even have agency, but we still need to have some control compared to, as you laid out, Elliot, we can socially organize and be able to do all the things necessary to take care of ourselves if we're left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you sure can. And we've got the brain trust to do it. We've got the brain trust, and all of it is not in those Ivy League schools either. There's a lot in the community. There's a brothers and sisters in our community that got sharp with it.
Oh, yeah.
These are the same folks that can fix a car and never been to school for auto mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of wit. We've got that kind of wit in our community. We always have. Had it. And so, and when we look back at things that were built, they were built by men and women who didn't have that college-educated Ivy League backing.
Mm.
Honorable Elijah Muhammad didn't go to college.
Yeah.
Murray McLeod Bethune started one. He didn't have that formal education like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got the wit. We just got to bring them together and find a way not to be so hostile with each other.
Right. And that's one. One thing again that they constructed is, I'm an advocate that even though it seems kind of monolithic, but those structures where the political debate could take place and policy can be formulated, but primarily the differences can be at least heard and be respected. I don't believe we have those structures now. And I believe the last time we had that structure was in the 70s during those conventions. So without that, and without people with their different perspectives on what is the solution and clarity, we're not going to be, all we will be is arguing with each other, or seem like arguing with each other. And the environment makes it to where you can argue and not even be in each other's face.
Right.
You can be a million miles away.
Yes.
And have hostility and never be able to see each other face to face, or see each other and it's so distant that you can't work out over a period, because you can stay in your silo. And that's where the relationship and social networks
comes into
play, because you can't do that all the time virtually.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And like you said, those safety barriers that were there in those years back, they like I said, they're not there anymore. We go now, we get people that are mimicking. They're mimicking what they think is power and money.
Mm.
Mm. And it's not good anywhere. I mean, you may do some individual things, and I'm not knocking your Oprahs and your Tyler Perrys and, you know, your rappers with the big money and the ball players, but, you know, it's individual wealth. They got to collectively pull that together, mm-hmm. you know, and they're not doing that in the way that needs to be done for community building.
Right.
Martin Luther King asked the question back during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. He said, where do we go from here? Mm. Chaos or community?
And that question still is here. Still needs an answer.
Where do we go from here?
Dr. Rogers, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And
thank you for having me, my brother. Thank you.
We'll talk soon.
Great. Okay. Take care. Brother Richard, take care of yourself.
Yeah, you too, sir. Okay. I have to say, Dr. Rogers, that I lost my phone in the cab. And for 2 weeks, I was, as one person I heard say, I was undone.
Yep, I was too.
I don't know. Just, I mean, when I realized it was gone, and then you like, I don't even talk about it. So I'm just saying I empathize and I sympathize with you.
Right. If it hadn't been for my daughter coming over here with her phone, I wouldn't have made it. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Talk to you later. Richard.
Yeah.
Interesting discussion with Dr. Yeah. Rogers, and you know, these things are going to continue. You know, we were scheduled to have the guest that I shared with you the information about next week,
right?
But I want to see, we might be able to push it to Sunday. We're going to have a guest either way Sunday. I got to kind of see what's going on with that. I think that'll be an interesting show either way, whether it's this Sunday or next Sunday.
Great. Yeah, there's a lot going on, and it shifts to give some example. You know, always looking for the examples, and if that comes out as since it's current, they may be able to provide some insight on the dynamics there.
Yeah, and I posted a couple articles on Time for Awakening, the Facebook page, about some of the economic things going on the continent.
Right.
Did you see some of those things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
See, a lot of those things, Richard, how people got to look deeply at what's going on.
Mm.
It ain't all gloom and doom and nobody's doing anything. And it's always going to be a percentage of our people that are active and that's going to move everybody forward. But it's always going to be a large percentage. And I don't want to say large. It's going to be a percentage of our people that like to just talk and never do anything. But it's always, if you look back at anything that we've done, whether it's been in this struggle or before we got to these lands, it's always been a percentage of people, sometimes small, that have moved the nation. And I don't think it's going to be any different now.
Me neither.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Sunday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.
Right now they seem to play such a small part of.
To save the children.